Okay, I think we are ready to tackle the next question.
What you have to do, go to www.as.org. Meander around, you'll find a thing that has a membership application. For associate membership, you just fill it out and send in your money. For regular membership, you actually have to get 3 AES members, well, some number, typically 3, to sign your application. Bring it to the next section meeting and we'll fix that.
I need to correct you a little bit on that.
Yep.
For an associate member, you're not required to have a four-year degree or equivalent experience and so on. So basically anyone can be an associate member. They'd like to have 2 references of some sort on the application.
For associate?
For associate.
Cool.
For full member, they are looking for people who have a four-year degree or equivalent experience or something like that. And they're looking for the 3 references. And references don't have to be AES members. If you have an employer or something like that, kind of like a job reference. But anyone here would be glad to give you a reference. You, if you want to run the AES.
So for student memberships, is that like once you're not no longer going to school and whatnot, does it just carry over to an associate membership, or just remain student?
You have to become an associate member. You can only be a student member as long as you're in a program that leads to a degree.
But my guess is they have no way of knowing.
I don't think they'd believe me.
The other question that you have to answer is whether or not you want to get the journal. And I have a copy with me, so I'll show you what that's all about.
The journal is relatively accessible. It doesn't get intensely technical too often.
Well, you have the choice of getting it in PDF over the web, or getting the paper version, which just costs you more money to get actual paper.
That's basically it. If you want to get a copy of the journal sent to your house, then the membership is increased proportionally. Personally, I like getting paper copies because I travel a lot, and when I'm sitting on an airplane, that's a good time to read the journal. And also, with my eyesight, I don't like to be reading a lot off the I don't like to be reading off the laptop all the time.
On the downside, it's clay coat, and the suckers are heavy.
Yeah.
When you have 30 years of them, it does tend to weigh down a corner of the office.
You need a voracious shelf.
Yeah. Or you just become friends with Dennis Bond up at Rain, because he has every single AES journal that was ever published, and you just go into his library and read the article.
I've also bought
the
CD.
Whether you should join or not? Does anyone want to?
Well,
should you join? Why should you join? What do we do? What you ask, right? Anyone want
to? Well, there's 2 things. One of them, of course, is the local meetings, which you don't have to be a member for, but you get to vote and nudge the leadership of the local meetings. Like if there's a talk or something you want, you can push it. Of course, you can push it as a non-member too, because if you tell me, I'll go find out. But basically what you get is you get the journal and you get a lot of connections to new equipment, stuff like that. You'll see a fair number of ads in the back of the thing, reviews of patents, which are sometimes, when Asperger does them, it's sort of comic. But basically it'll help you stay connected to what's changing. If you come to a convention, it knocks almost the cost of your membership off the convention, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And conventions, if you go to the paper sessions, are much higher test. But if you just go to the convention floor at the convention, is probably the best way I know about to find out what everybody sells. Because with very few exceptions, everybody comes and everybody brings lots of stuff, and you get to go play with it.
Right.
And the people that are there generally are the people that know about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
As opposed to the salesman who got a steal from the local rep, and so now we're talking at least three generations lost. Yeah. The source.
Generally, the people, the level of people you meet are the people who taught the local rep, who taught the salesman. So, if you have a question about the guts of something, that's where you'll find out.
Because chances are the guy that designed it is there.
Yeah, and it may take a few minutes to track him down, but
because he's probably in one of the papers.
Yeah. One of the more practical level at the convention, we have the papers that are the guys that are thinking up all this stuff. And we have the floor where we have the hardware that they're showing you, and you can talk to the folks. But in between, there are seminars, and there are workshops, and these are much more practical environments for 99% of us that belong, to go and see our peers talk and discuss the issues of the day, and some with a little interaction with the audience, and you can, there's a lot to learn there, and that's something that you get access to. If you're a member,
one thing I'd been pushing for a while, and I've been papers chair for a bunch of the New York conventions, was a tutorials track. And I think the last two conventions they've done tutorials tracks. So you have three tracks. You have the papers, which is the most technical. You have the tutorials track, which is deliberately educational. The tutorials may repeat from convention to convention because you get a new audience. And then you have the workshops, which are, you know, basically, you know, George Massenberg sitting up there arguing with somebody about how to produce CDs, which can be really enlightening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's the workshops, which more address the interaction of art and technology. There's the tutorials track, which teaches more or less the guts of it, not at a very high level, but at least so that you can go and look at the equipment, know what it means. And then there's the papers track, if you really want to know how to design a quadrature mirror filter, and go to the papers track. And then there's the floor, which is basically, I call it open warfare between manufacturers. That's how I like way to put it.
Take no prisoners.
Take no prisoners, you know, like, here, try my candy. No, try my candy. Have my key ring. What?
Mine is better.
What?
Yeah, my candy is better.
Yes, you get
that. Yes.
Yeah.
So you could go to that web address and look at the program from last week's convention, and you can get a feel for what's there, what's to see. Look at the list of exhibitors, because it's basically a who's who in audio. If you look at the papers, a lot of the presenters may be names that you're familiar with. And these are real people doing real work. I would call the AES the audio equivalent of the AMA.
Yeah, I think one of the things we left out was that the AES, if I understand it correctly, is the body that is, you know, it's the base of standards that are created for this particular world, and those standards can extend to a lot of different places, and these are the people who generate those standards and discuss what they should be.
Actually, I can address that a little bit more. There is a standards group, an ANSI-accredited standards group within the AES called the AES Standards Committee, which actually is a group of committees, but why it's called one committee, you have to understand how ANSI works. But it's basically a committee of one person with a billion subgroups that have about 40 people in each. That make standards like the AES-EBU interface, standards for testing, and so on. That's one of the parts of the AES that's relatively quiet and sits in the corner and is a little bit exclusive. But if you have an issue with testing or something like that, it's certainly something you can go to and push for resolving the problem. And then there's another part of the AES, which is called the Technical Council, which is the more academic end of the AES. Although right now the Technical Council has been pushing a lot to do tutorials. You can blame me for that. I've been, I think, arguing for 12 years now they should be doing tutorials. And it took me 4 years to get them to do the first one. But now they have a complete track. So one of the things I think is, one of the things about the AES is you can learn a lot you might not expect to learn. You know, like I didn't know that. Happens to me.
Yeah, I think there's another thing here, too. Peers is a really important concept here, because any place that you live geographically, there's going to be some number of people that have an interest in audio. And out of those people, there might be an even smaller fraction that have made the effort to educate themselves and get involved in learning, you know, what's really going on with all this stuff. So there's a very strong sort of a pyramid effect that happens here. And so in every locality, you're going to find that there's going to be a few individuals who really have studied and they want to learn more. But then where are their peers? Where are the other people that they can associate with that have also, you know, worked themselves up to that level of understanding? And so, you know, there's thousands of people in the AES, but compared to the population of the world, it's minuscule. So this is a way for those of us, you know, that are interested at this level of being able to connect with one another and be able to then, you know, teach each other and work together to keep moving this thing forward.
It's very similar to Alcoholics Anonymous in that way.
I could add a few things. Every profession has got an organization where the people network and educate each other and human education. And that's what I think the AES is. It's the professional organization. It represents everyone. Everyone can share their ideas, teach each other, and so on. And
debate.
And debate. And with an air of you know, credibility. Engineers, degreed engineers, as well as people who aren't. I often like to do the name-dropping thing if people are interested in the AES and they wonder why they should come. I say, well, if you wanted to come to an AES convention, they have one in the U.S. each year. It's on alternate coasts. Last week it was in San Francisco. Next October it'll be in New York City and comes back to the West Coast. But it's international. Everyone in the world who deals in audio is going to be there. If you want to talk to Ray Dolby, he's usually there at his booth. You go to his booth and you talk to the guy who invented the Dolby system. Well, where else are you going to be able to do
Rupert
that?
Neve.
Rupert Neve.
Yeah.
You want to talk to Rupert? Rupert's at his booth. You can go there.
Walk around and say hi to Rupert.
Tom Holman invented the THX system.
He'll be everywhere.
He's a good buddy of mine now. He will be,
as far as I can say, he subdivides into eight people because he will be everywhere in the convention.
Yeah, yeah.
You can meet Neville Teal and Richard Small there. Teal and Small of Teal Small.
You can play with $1 million consoles.
You can meet George Massacre.
And the guy will sit there with you and show you everything about it. You don't really have to even pretend you're going to buy one. You know, you never get a chance to do that kind of stuff anywhere else, as far as I can tell.
Bootsy Collins was at New York last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, there's always some really cover
of artists. Right? Well, Steve Miller was in San Francisco.
Okay.
Presentation. And I don't know how many other name drops can you come up with?
Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder's been to a few. Mm-hmm. He's kind
of... Actually, I ran into Ray Manzarek last week.
Ray Manzarek at the Doors, yeah. I saw Cotaro once. He was buying a hot dog at the snack stand.
Alan Parsons.
Parsons,
yeah. There.
Yeah. As well as the famous people in the industry that most people maybe haven't heard, like Bob Ludwig. He's a mastering engineer. He's
George Massenberg.
George Massenberg.
Chuck Ainley was walking around the floor.
Bob Katz
was there. Chuck Ainley.
It's difficult to get him out of Florida, too.
Sometimes you can get drinks with these guys, or go have their maybe group dinner or something. Hey, can I come? Sure.
Roger Nichols was at his booth all week.
And you find out
software.
And you find out most of them have a reasonable user interface too. when you get to the middle level, sometimes there's a lot of ego, but when you get up to the top, people are actually pretty even. And most of them really like to teach. You'll find out that seems to go for almost all of them. They really want you to... They're an enthusiast. They want to explain why this works this way. I mean, if you ask Neville Teal about speakers, you've got about a four-hour conversation.
Or Leif Mesis over at the prison room. Okay. Just go on and on and on and on. You can't get away from Blake. I mean, he's gonna tell you the whole story from the day he started working for ABBA.
And this electric electrode capacitor, I don't use anymore because
Literally, he will. He's a commander.
Another thing about the conventions is that whichever city it is usually has some technical tours. You pay a little extra money, get in the bus. And some of the technical tours were local studios, and Industrial Light and Magic was a popular one. They have a new facility at the Letterman Center in the Presidio in San Francisco. So if you wanted a tour of that, well,
where did AES,
they go this year? AES had a bunch of tours.
Hmm? We go to Hyde Street this year.
The studio.
Yeah, I believe so.
I don't remember.
Either that, or there was a part. There was a party that was generally open to everyone there one of the nights. I don't know. Then there's the matter of the local section, us. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I don't recall if you've been to many of our meetings.
No. This is the first. Coming from my point of view, as I'm someone who has sort of slipped from the underground into actually becoming an educator, and I don't have a degree. I got to be honest, but I've been teaching kids how to do live sound for 5 years and getting paid for it, which is crazy. And,
it makes you a pro.
Yeah, it makes me a pro. So here I am, I'm about to turn 36 this year, and I still feel like I'm a young person, but I do see the fact that in the future, of course, I'm going to want to be involved, I have to thank you again for coming in here, because this was, just for me to be able to sit in the audience was super fun, and to meet everybody on the panel was super excellent, too. But it really opens my eyes as to, how far-reaching things can really be. And I have to admit, I've been an underground producer engineer for probably about 10 years now, but I've only been doing records that probably only get national distribution if they get anything. So it's a different level for me to see, I've read magazines.
But what? That's 99% of records made.
I have to admit, I've always kind of,
Most of us who make records, are bread and butter.
Yeah,
records
that
they might press 1,000 or 1,500 copies. And that really is the bread and butter out of all but maybe 50 or 60 high-end engineers and producers at any point in time in the world.
The music I listen to, they really don't press any more than 5,000
copies.
As an observation, your experience in teaching people at the low levels is something that the education committee desperately needs.
I think it's a really, I have a really weird viewpoint from, I think I came about it sort of organically, and to see you guys and hear you talk, I find it to be actually an inspiration, really.
Well, what I'm suggesting that if you find yourself going to a convention, you might see if you can find the education committee and hang out and listen to them a little while and maybe offer some suggestions, because it isn't, one of the points that I've been making with those folks for a while is it's not all schooling. And it hasn't been the easiest thing in the world to convince them of this.
So another, since you're not familiar with the local section, the society has sections, which basically amount to interest groups in most major cities. There are also student sections at many colleges and universities. The Art Institute, for instance, has a student section, and we're trying to encourage Shoreline to develop one. Okay. Here in the Northwest, we're blessed with a particularly active section. Other cities have not been quite as lucky. For instance, Portland's section has died and been reborn two or three times, and it's currently in hiatus. So we have meetings more or less once a month, although October we have two meetings this month. Every month except December, we try not to compete with Santa Claus.
When this year, December?
And summer.
And we don't compete with vacations in the summer. Okay? You can go to the website and look at the archive of past meeting notices, and in most cases you can find reports about what happened at the meeting. And sometimes the reports go into great detail, and sometimes they don't. And it's kind of a matter of who wrote it up and how they felt that day. But you can kind of see what we have done in the past, and that's kind of what we're likely to do in the future.
and our meetings range from really nerdy to pretty hands-on. I'd call the mastering engineering panel, that was pretty hands-on. Our last meeting with Dan Lavery, who's a manufacturer of high-end converters who happens to live on Bainbridge, that was pretty nerdy.
But funny. He's a funny man.
Yeah. Anyway, I think there's something for everyone there.
And we're always free.
Yeah, that's true.
With the rare exception of a special event. We've been doing more of those special events, and they've been good. Those have been fun.
What's your local membership, like population, how many people do you have in your chapter?
I don't have the numbers. My guess is it's 200 something.
When you have a meeting, is there 200 people?
No. Yeah. No, depends.
Yeah, it really depends. An average meeting might be anywhere from 40 to 50 people, but it's not unusual that we'll have a meeting on something that people are really interested in where we could have 100 plus people show up. For instance, when we did the mastering panel, we did that over at Shoreline and we packed that room. There was definitely over 100 people there.
And I'd say from 20 to 200. Sometimes meetings that take place at facilities draw really well. Like we did when Dolby introduced Dolby S, we had that meeting at Bad Animals, and we had an overflow crowd.
And you don't have to be a member to come. Everyone's welcome.
Yep.
That makes it even more interesting to be
in. I think we should move on to another question. Yeah. We've still got some time left, so at this stage, I'd say ask us another one. It's really something else you want to know about.
When you join the membership, does it start and end? When you join,
it's yearly.
It's yearly.
So at this stage of the game, if you're thinking about joining, you probably just wait until January.
Yeah.
Good question.
It has to be about audio.
Did you ask if we wanted to complain about anything? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I'll complain about something. I'll ask you a question because you're a young person.
Okay. I'm not too good.
Well, do you perceive any particular value in a, if you take two CDs, one in your player, and then put the other in the player, don't touch any of the controls, especially that volume control, and one's louder. Do you like one better than the other?
One louder than the
other. Yeah, it just plays back louder without changing the settings. Is that
I
a big deal
really
to you?
I like noise, but some
people do. That's a little bit of a loaded question, I mean, especially given your lineage here.
I didn't get too really upset at me because, you know, there's some things that, you know, like to be played loud and I always walk up.
She chose staring down on me.
So I chose exactly the wrong person to ask.
You chose a person who doesn't like loud noise, who has an acoustician for a dad.
Okay.
I personally, I only buy CDs that are L1 into a flat line.
you had a comment about it. Yeah, you know where I'm going here.
Well, I don't know.
You're starting to sound a lot like Bob Cass.
You know, Bob is just the vocal one.
Well,
everybody feels this way, and it's just kind of a funny thing. You know, we are mercenaries. We work for a living.
Bob and I have some fun on this.
And when people ask us to turn the thing up, we can't say no. You know, we have to do what we have to do, or they're going to go to my competitor.
If it's too loud, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, but they can't make you like it.
They can't make me like it. And I'm just curious how people feel about it. Whether
this actually has to do with another thing I was going to bring up. But I like it louder if the music has been mixed with a greater dynamic range, like quiet and loud instruments in the same mix at appropriate points. But if it's kind of suppressed and all the same volume, then I'll probably tend to prefer it quiet. We'll have to set the volume and the quiet range.
Well, see, what we're talking about two different things, aren't we? We're talking about
the
relative level of the disc itself.
It depends on the music. So an objective measurement of the volume, like the waveform on the disc.
What you're saying is
you don't
care for it all squeezed and smacked. And,
well, one thing that
and
I found
the funny thing is your arm can reach right over there, take that volume control, turn right up if you like it loud.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the thing is I like it when it starts out low and then goes to like a higher level of like noise. I find that everybody turns it up more because they want to hear the beginning, but then it gets intolerable as it goes up. But that's
right. So there's a middle ground.
Also,
it's kind of that spot.
The other thing I like is if I turn it up, I like to go far away from it, but I like it having it up.
Like spark field.
If I had a choice of like volume, I would have it like really, really far up, but I would be really far away too.
My answer to your question is what I'm complaining about is CDs that are just loud for the sake of being louder than
the
CD.
Oh, no, I don't like that.
At the same volume set. Now, the problem is, of course, that we live in this world of the iPod and the MP3 and people load all these songs into their machine and then they want them to all come out at the same volume.
I bring AirPods to
well,
events, so
that is possible. That is actually, sorry, I don't want to make this into an advertisement, but if you look in the Windows Vista, there's a thing that calls itself loudness EQ. Loudness equalization, which actually does a loudness model, not an energy model, but a loudness model, and compresses things with a loudness model. It's specifically included because of the difference between analog television and digital television.
Well, I've never doubted that the technology existed for smoothing out the playback of given boxes.
It's just
that why are we doing it at the content end?
Why do we have to do it at the wrong end?
Yeah.
Some computer media players that are designed for ripping your whole library to will pre-scan all the tracks and equalize on a per album basis.
But, you know, that's actually better than a per track basis.
But because it can look ahead.
The only difficulty with doing that sort of thing is that what metric they use for deciding what loud is, because, you know, loudness can vary by a factor of 10 for any given energy level.
They use some measure of the amplitude. I don't think they typically look at the frequency.
There's a several hour discussion to be had here, but I probably don't want to do it today.
I like it quieter, but I also like the ability to turn it up, and I can do that by myself.
That's far too mature.
I just wanted to make an observation about loud versus soft. If you actually run experiments and find out where people stop on the dial, on the radio dial, in fact, they will stop on the loud one. Now, this is what the broadcasters hear. However, there is also a fair amount of data that shows that they won't stay there. And this is, I think, one of the big problems I've seen in the music industry is they're making all the CDs loud, but people are finding out they don't want to listen to them for more than 5 minutes.
They're fatiguing. They wear you out.
Yeah. It's the domain of the one hit wonder now, though. It's the iPod generation. And you're like, well, I'm downloading the one song off the album that I actually like, right?
Yep.
And it's like even worse than the 50s and 60s where the single was the biggest thing. You know, we've gotten back to the single then, right? That's what it seems like to me. And I mean, I know way earlier we were talking about mastering, and the whole thing is exactly what you were saying. Okay, all of us audio engineers pretty much in this room probably hate that super incredibly L1 clips, you know, everything's super in your face. It makes the mix sound bad in my opinion, and I just don't like it. But that's what everybody's doing, and so what you're saying is you know, sometimes you just have to tap. So what I'm wondering is you know, I mean, is there no way that we can convince people that they don't know how to listen to music?
Curiously enough, there have been a couple of episodes in the last year alone where people have backed this thing down at the artist's direction in both cases, which is encouraging. I'm not sure that we could call this a groundswell.
I think people are starting to realize the problem, though.
But there is starting to be more and more press about the fatigue issue.
Sorry, can I?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I have a pet peeve here. I have had 20-year-old students who use, well, at that point it was tape Walkman, who have worse hearing than I do at age 50, and there's a whole generation coming up, many of whom are going to have impaired hearing before they graduate from college. And this ultra compression is not helping, it's actually hurting, because one of the things that happens in the cochlea is the fatigue, you know, it takes the outer hair cells actually have to metabolize sugar and oxygen to repolarize. And this is really the way the regulatory method in the ear works. And if this is happening, you know, when you have a broadband signal that continues to be broadband and loud, this is more or less maximizing the fatigue. So, you know, the business we're in depends on people being able to hear.
One interesting way of convincing people that their product is actually harming people, and that maybe they're
you have no idea. You don't want
to. Equivalent of the FDA or whatever.
Well,
you can't master your record this way.
Or here's the problem. Everybody has. Here's the problem, and it's physiological. Everybody has a volume control. And as you go into something called temporary threshold shift, which is the first thing that happens when you start moving along toward impairment, it sounds quieter, so you turn it up. And this induces more temporary threshold shift, so you turn it up more, and pretty soon you've got a permanent threshold shift, so you're turning it up even more. And it's just insidious, and that's bad.
I think I have one that's in the car, is if you turn it really down low, so you can barely hear it, wait for 15 minutes, then turn it down farther.
Not typical.
What are you raising here?
Well, like I said,
and how do we get more of them?
She's 16 going on 40. You know, what can I tell you? Well, I have an entire
You're an
family.
Exception. A delightful exception.
I have an entire family. I play music louder than anybody else in my house. And people
it's like 30 dB or something.
And it's not that loud either. And they will come. Somebody will just come walking up the steps, just walk past the stereo and turn it down on me, in the middle of the dark side of the moon. What?
So, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, 5 levels, right?
Yeah.
They're tiny levels. 5 levels. You're playing one-on-one level, and I'm all the way downstairs in the basement, and I can hear.
Well, that's because there's an open air path. About 4 feet by 20 feet wide between you and it. I mean,
I don't care.
And it's freaking Floyd.
It's Floyd. Come on.
Yeah, come on. You have to leave.
Yeah, my
friend
thinks it's kind
of
funny. Earplugs are going backpack.
I don't. I used to get when I was at Bell Labs. I actually got my boss to buy me one of those big packs of 200 sets of the little EAR plugs. I just used to pass them out to people, especially college students who were already showing more impairment than I was. I just tell them to go wear them for 4 hours and then take them out. Sometimes this makes the point.
My younger daughter uses them so she doesn't have to hear her sister.
What? I know. Well, no, the older one in my family doesn't even need the earplugs to do that.
Yeah.
Selective deafness.
Yes, very yeah. Selective deafness, dad and the younger daughter.
And mom.
Oh, yes.
Notice what you're saying. Like, if you're telling me to, like, empty the dishwasher, I don't hear you.
This is a different problem. This is the cognitive problem.
Now she's starting to sound normal.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a teenager. Anyhow, any other questions?
I got a question there.
Yeah.
Not really a question. I had the opportunity to work for a firm. One of the things we did was articulation testing on exposure to the cabins of commercial jet airlines.
Ooh.
To look at the fatigue versus the ability to hear speech over the headphones. We found that the articulation set at a level where we expected 100% accuracy on hearing speech. We didn't find any problems. That was also part of our technique telling people noise is okay as long as you increase
your noise. For a variety of reasons, I don't have any comment on that at the minute, but I might in the near future. I saw it.
Do you have my invitation?
What? What?
Statue of
no.
Just to run out.
No.
No, it's the product of this.
Possibly.
Blue,
it's the official AES color.
Yeah.
Well, these are black.
No, not the writing. The blue. The background. The pen over there.
Yeah, the website is heavily cyan.
I painted this wall earlier.
I do notice that the cooler is blue and so is the trash can.
I'm starting to freak out.
By the way, so is your pants.
So is your shirt.
My shirt isn't. Oh, it is.
I think we finally have the secret of 9/11 solved.
Well, I was kind of interested by the airline comment. Was that like the percent outcomes testing of people in the airplane? Was that the percentage articulation loss of consonants tests in airplanes?
It was actually in the pilot, the tower.
Pilot to tower, not the passenger.
That's even more important.
Yeah, so we sent actually a flight to New York to a couple of planes to record sound levels, and then we synthesized it in an exposure chamber and had people come in and out for different periods of time and did pre and post audio frames.
Uh-huh. So you actually had a human subject doing the test rather than doing it with a computer and having the computer calculate it. Most of you know what we're talking about here with the percent all codes test?
No, but I'd like to know.
Okay, let's explain that. Back in the days when we didn't have a lot of the kinds of test equipment that we have nowadays, people had to come up with clever ways to test rooms, and one of them was this idea of articulation and how much of it have you got. And this is something that actually leads into kind of a tangential but highly related issue, which is what is it that you're trying to accomplish by making sound in the room? And if what you're trying to accomplish is to communicate some concept or speech or something like that, then what really matters is if someone speaks, does the other person not only hear the fact that they're speaking, but do they understand what they're saying? And this transcends the idea of volume, because the obvious thing to do if somebody doesn't hear you is to make it louder. But making something louder does not necessarily guarantee that you're going to communicate and the person is going to be able to hear what you're saying.
Just put a 40 millisecond delay on and play the two things at equal levels and see how much articulation you get.
Right.
It doesn't matter how loud you turn it up.
So we established this concept of articulation, and articulation basically relates to the idea of, are you actually understanding what it is that's being said? Once we establish that concept, then we have to have a way to test for it. So the way that this was done is a list of words was developed, and a person would get up in front of the room and they would read this list of words. Then there would be individuals that would be sprinkled out in various places around the building, and they'd have a pencil and a paper, and they would basically be recording what they're hearing. And afterwards, you could go back and you could score the results and find out what was the percentage of all the consonants that were uttered that people were actually understanding. And so this was just then a percentage of all consonants was then just abbreviated to percent all cons.
There's also a modification there called the dynamic rhyme test.
Oh, go ahead.
It basically involves using pairs of words that rhyme.
Oh, right, right.
And that, in some sense, at least for telecom, has proven to be even more useful. But these two measures, just to point out, have nothing to do with intensity or signal-to-noise ratio. And you can have a really high signal-to-noise ratio and not have a clue what somebody's saying if you've got the wrong filtering.
Yes, I think we're about to conduct the test.
I don't know if the list is in or not.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's in this edition.
It might be.
What was that 40 millisecond delay that we were talking about?
Well, if you take something and you put a 40 millisecond delay and then you can't understand what it is.
Well,
I can't really do it with my voice, but if you have a digital delay, just play something back with a single tap of 40 milliseconds or up to a quarter of a second and try to understand what the person said.
We can simulate it. Ryan, start uttering the alphabet.
A, B,
A,
C,
B,
C,
D,
E,
F,
G,
G,
Okay.
Way too far apart.
Yeah, but you get the idea. Yeah. You've got stuff coming at you, and
it's
then you've
like,
got it coming
like
at you again.
Off the back of the room.
A slap echo is a classic example of what doesn't. Yeah, that's a classic example of one of the problems you get into.
Yeah.
Of course, the other problem you get into slap echo is that we have over about 80, 90 milliseconds delay, which is over a 40-foot room, and you have a strong slap echo. That also will make about 25, 30% of the speakers aphasic, because they'll be listening to that delay, and they'll actually start to stutter. If you want to drive somebody nuts, put headphones on, put a quarter second delay into the headphones, and if they've ever done an announcement in a football stadium, they'll have no trouble because they'll just turn it off.
Yeah.
But if they're used to listening to normal conversations, they just won't even be able to talk. Just one word at a time, one syllable, and they have to wait for that syllable to complete.
Oh, yeah.
Like
the computer.
There's another issue here that's related to this as well. And right now we're talking about the obvious case, which would be a slapback echo. But besides the slapback echo, we also have to be concerned about something which is called a path length differential.
Oh.
So I'm going to erase the AES website here. If you still haven't gotten written down, you can always ask us for it again. Yeah, and I'm going to show you a really classic case here of what we're talking about. First, I'll illustrate. We have a sound source here at this side of the room, and we've got sound that's hitting the audience, and maybe that sound is also hitting off the back wall and coming back into the audience, and it may be coming back over such a long period of time that you do hear that obvious slapback echo, and that can make it really difficult to understand. But let's take another case here where the amount of distance isn't as far. And remember, it takes sound time to travel a given distance. And so if you think about it, for any given distance that you have, there is going to be an equivalent amount of time that's going to go along with that. So this idea of the linkage of time and path length is really important. Right. 1 foot per millisecond is the ballpark number.
It's actually a little more than a foot per millisecond, about 1 foot per millisecond.
That,
good enough.
Yeah, close enough. So here's what happens. What we're really getting into now is this idea of signals that are arriving out of time with each other and creating either smearing to the point where you actually get some kind of change in the spectral response.
Wow.
So we can have a situation here. A really common one where you've got a room where you've got a balcony. And now the sound is hitting the balcony and immediately going back down to the audience. There isn't enough path-length differential here to create a discrete echo, so you're not suffering from that problem. But what you can have happening here is if we look at the waveform that's being generated, you'd have the original waveform, and then right afterwards you'd have another one, where you've got some kind of a phase difference. Now, what will end up happening here is across the frequency spectrum, we're going to have this path length differential, however great it is going to be equal to some frequency. And so when we end up having those frequencies being in the vocal range, if those frequencies end up coming in, the second one ends up coming in being 180 degrees out of phase with the first one, then you're going to get a cancellation. And so what we sometimes find in these situations with balconies and other things can cause this as well, you might find that you might have a cancellation in the vocal region that's going to occur at certain seats in the seating area. And when the person sits there, there isn't anything that's going to help this, because if you're there, you might find the vocal region could be down 6-9 dB, you know, and the articulation is going to be really poor there because people aren't going to be getting those key frequencies. So
and
this
just
situation.
Point out, you have a little bit of trouble understanding what I'm saying right now. That's because you're hearing me a foot away, but you're also hearing the loudspeakers 20 feet away. And you notice it starts to get hard to understand, especially if they talk real fast. So that's the live version of showing the problem with delay right here. That's why I walked back here with the microphone.
Yeah. So anyways, there's a couple things you could do in a situation like this. First thing would be architectural. Balcony wouldn't necessarily be flat-faced. You might do a balcony that's shaped like this.
so that it redirects the energy upwards instead of down into the audience. Of course, now it could bounce off of something else and end up back in the audience, and you'd be back where you started from. But the other thing that can be done here is this balcony face might not only be slanted, but it could also be designed to be absorptive.
Or dispersive.
And both. So there's a technique called abfusion, where we create a device which will absorb energy, but whatever energy it doesn't absorb, it will also diffuse. So the key thing here is a situation like that, we don't necessarily want to let a hard impact strike on a surface and then have all of that energy be redirected back outwards again.
Yeah.
We don't want it to be a discrete packet of energy. What we want to do is we want to somehow do something to this surface so that when it hits, the energy gets broken up in lots of different places, because in the process of doing that, you're minimizing how much energy is going to go to any one place.
And well, more than that, you also minimize the depth of the contour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And a good way to think about this, because this also relates to so many other things, I'm going to put the mic down and use my hands here to assess it. If you were to... Okay. Let's say that I had some device that could disperse 180 degrees. Let's say I had 180 units of energy, so there was one unit of energy for every degree. All right. Now, if I take that and I change that to a device that now disperses over 90 degrees, but I've still got the same amount of energy, now I've got two units of energy for every degree. If I tighten it up even more, the amount of energy per degree is going to continue to increase. So anytime you can take that energy and you can focus it, you're going to be beaming a higher intensity of energy to a narrower area. So this is something that occurs in horns and waveguides. And
curved walls in the back.
Yeah, exactly. Architectural things. If we take this and we go the other way around where we're spreading it out, you know, now we have a lot of energy, but we're spreading it over a really wide energy, then the energy at any given point drops accordingly.
I think the point to hammer home here is, well, there's a term called specular echo, which means something that directly mirrors or reflects the wave that hits it. And the whole point here is that specular reflections are bad. Diffuse reflections can be bad, but not necessarily have to be. Specular reflections, I suppose you could come up with a time when they're good, but can you think of a time when it's actually good to have a delayed specular reflection? I can't actually.
I guess it would be relative to something else.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean,
that's just a slap echo.
Well, that's bad.
No, as a musical form.
We're talking about as articulation. As a musical form, it's fair game. Whatever sounds cool is what you use. That's not what we're addressing here. We're talking about how you play it back. And if you put the slap echo as a musical form, that's great. But if you add another one in the room when you play it back, that could come out profoundly weird. There's another point I want to make starting on this is that if you have echoes that are close in time, like under 10 milliseconds, the ear will actually tend to de-emphasize these echoes, although you will still get the frequency shaping. You have to remember that. But as you get out of the 10 millisecond range, you will start to get to the point where the ear will start to treat this as two events. When you get up to 60 milliseconds, you'll actually hear it as an echo. And these numbers are sort of important because the one thing you can do to completely disrupt things is to have a specular reflection out of the 60 millisecond range. That's just, well, we could discuss some auditoriums I've worked in the past, but you've met them, I'm sure.
Yeah, we have to put sound systems in them.
Yes. But basically, like, for instance, if you look at the back wall here, that wall would just love to have some diffusers, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you got that right. We're lucky we have this floor in here. Otherwise, I think this place would be impossible to do sound.
Oh, I've worked in worse. I have worked. One of the auditoriums I used to do when I was in college had a curved back wall. The curved back wall wasn't very curvy. It focused about on the stage, about a foot back from the edge of the stage, is where the entire back wall focused. To say that this was a feedback disaster is probably too kind. There were words for it, but I'm probably not allowed to use them in this building. But this is the kind of thing. It does, you know, architecturally it looked cool. It was this basically thing made out of small glass windows that arc, and it was this cool looking thing. But one of the things that I always found is working in acoustics, I've always found myself in a war with the architect.
Oh, you know, this,
yes. The architect wants these cool looking smooth surfaces. And when you're doing acoustics, cool looking is okay, but smooth is right out.
The architects also tend to want to override the engineers in terms of the speakers. We want that speaker because it's cute.
No. Or because it's small. This is where the acoustician learns to say, no.
Yeah. But that happens all the time.
It's the Bose syndrome.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even if they listen to the speakers and they know that this one sounds better, they might take that one just because they like the way it looks. But actually, I want to go off on a tangent.
I mean, isn't that why iPods sell? I mean, isn't that why Macintoshes?
Well, but it is why Bose sells.
Yeah,
not so much for you. But, you know, Bose is an interesting thing because they do all this indirect sound. And 30% of the population likes highly indirect sound. Guess who Bose sells to?
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong because it's the preference that people have. But that's who they sell to.
I'm going to go off on a tangent here, if I can, about this idea of curved surfaces, just to sort of show you how powerful a curved surface can be. In England, before the invention of radar, they wanted to have a way to detect planes that were coming across the English Channel. And so if you go over to the coast of England, you'll actually find that they have constructed giant curved walls, and then they would have a listening post so that...
You basically stand at the focus.
Yeah, exactly right. So here's Europe over here, here's England over here, and on the coast, they'd have these giant curved walls that would focus the acoustical energy, and they'd have a listening post here right at the focal point, and the person would just be stationed there, and they would be listening for planes coming across the channel. And it worked extremely well, and that was their home defense system before radar was introduced in World War II.
And they have a demonstration of that right at the Pacific Science Center. They do dishes across from each other.
Yeah, there's another thing that happened. The Germans in World War I used it as artillery spotting. They made two great big metal trumpets on a bar about 20 feet wide and a turntable, and the trumpets came into a guy's ears. And he literally sat there, and they cranked the turntable around until he would indicate the artillery was centered. And they used this to locate the artillery.
Yeah.
It works.
To take that thing to the science center even farther, back before we had electronic forms of reproducing sound, there was communication setups like this where they would build reciprocal walls. They'd be sometimes at great distances to one another, and a person would go stand here, and then the other person would go stand there, and they would be able to talk over extremely long distances. And if I'm not mistaken, I think there was actually one that was constructed that allowed people to talk across the English Channel.
It only worked in good weather.
Yeah.
The thing it kills you is wind noise. The problem is just that the wind will actually add to the vector of the. The sound transmission across the channel and literally blow it away from the receiver on the other end so it just misses. So what happens, you could be there in the middle and a puff of wind in the middle of the channel is like, oh, you're back now?
Yeah, you're literally blown away.
Yep. The sound literally got blown away.
Oh, I think we've covered that one.
Next
question. You never found that they don't have the outcome system there?
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
I think we made up ours somewhat with theory in mind that the kinds of communications like squawk your transponder and other things like that are critical to those communications.
I think that makes a lot of sense because it's task specific.
That's the World Trade Tower, dude.
No, it's 72nd Street.
So, next question.
Twice.
If we don't have a next question, then I want to explain something about the
significance. Oh, you do have a question. But I do want to talk about the tape measure a little bit.
Well, this is on the order of what I consider the insidiousness of noise. But I'm bothered that the FCC doesn't seem to really care too much about their own regulations of keeping a constant level of sound between the program and the advertisements.
I can address that. The problem is the way that the constant level is defined is an RMS value. RMS value, and this is a regulation for RMS value, is not loudness. I wish I had my, I should have brought my laptop, I could play the demo. But you can vary loudness substantially for a given RMS level just by changing the bandwidth. The lighter the bandwidth, the louder it gets. And the whole trick with commercials, if you lower the bandwidth really loud, it's a lot louder. It's not any more energetic. This is how a lot of the compressors work. They actually give you less energy in the bass. But what they do is they basically squish everything to roughly a constant well, you know what articulation bands are. They're very close to the critical bands in hearing. If you have equal energy for a critical band, that maximizes loudness. And basically that's what these things try to do. And when they use this on commercials, they use these things called articulation enhancers, which basically squish the loudness ratio to zero, so the entire voice is as loud from beginning to end. And the RMS level doesn't go up, but it's loud. I left that an adjective.
I learned something.
That's why it's so annoying.
So,
yeah.
So, JJ, can that be undone?
No, it's a lossy process.
Crap.
Bingo. What?
You can't put something up between your TV and your
Well, now, the thing you can do, is that's why I'm talking about loudness equalization, is if you put in a compressor, you can actually compress loudness based on a loudness model. And loudness models are known. They've been known since the 1930s. People claim they're too complicated, but these days, you know, a 512-point FFT every 256 samples is what? One, you know, two zillionth of a Pentium, so it doesn't matter. You can do this, and then you can actually pull, you can equalize the loudness levels. Now, there are some questions. If you know, if you have a signal when you know you're changing channels, you can reacquire it for each one. If not, you'll get a fade. You know, when you switch from loud to soft, you'll have a drop and then it'll come back up. So you can do this. People don't, but you can do it. People have actually been pushing to actually use loudness metrics in the to measure radio stations. The problem is that doesn't really work because the RMS level is, in fact, the RMS level and the spectrum are, in fact, what matters to splashing outside your modulation bandwidth. So that is a valid regulation. The catch is that regulation, up until we had these ultra compressors, also sufficed to keep the loudness the same. But now we have the ultra compressors, it doesn't suffice to keep the loudness the same. And, well, I'm not a proponent of much additional regulation, but I make sure any time the commercial is really loud, I won't buy it. That's my vengeance. Yeah. That's my
car. Car commercials are always 100.
I buy a car every 10 years when my old one wears out.
Anybody have another question?
Tell us about the tape measure.
Oh, okay, the tape measure. If I can see your tape measure.
Oh, I want to give it back.
Oh, I promise.
Freezing. So if you look at the tape measure, you'll see, at least I can see if I put my other glasses on, that it's measured off in meters. It's not centimeters, I think. And it just, and when it first starts off, you see the corresponding frequency that equals that distance. But as you get farther down here, when you get to 800 hertz, you'll also notice that at 800 hertz there's a second number, which is a lighter color, which is 200 hertz. 200 hertz is one quarter of 800 hertz. So what we're talking about here is quarter wave relationships. And for the whole rest of this tape, what you're going to be looking at is what this was designed for specifically was for measuring pathways and for measuring quarter waves. I'll go back up to the whiteboard and I'll show you why the quarter wave is important, and then we're going to measure the distance from your basement to the water back.
So here's the idea. We've already
talked about this idea of what happens when we have signals that have different phase relationships. And we know that if we get into a situation where we have a signal and then we have that same signal that's got its polarity inverted up by 180 degrees, that it's going to cancel itself. And we know that somewhere in between here, as these signals shift in their phase relationships, that we can have some loss of signal, all the way up to the point where if both signals arrive at exactly the same time, we're going to get a reinforcement of the signal. Okay, so we can go anywhere from an addition that's going to raise the level to a complete cancellation. Now, in the case of a quarter wave, here's what we're really talking about. If I have a signal that is originating from a point that's near a wall, let's take the case of what happens if it's a wavelength away. It strikes the wall, and then it's going to bounce off the wall, and it's going to come back, and we don't have a problem. If anything, we might get a reinforcement. If we are a half wave away, and it will come, then it comes back a half wave, and once again, we don't have an issue with this. But when we get into a situation where we're a quarter wave away, if it's a quarter wave to the wall, then it's a quarter wave back. And what ends up coming back is going to be two quarters, which is one half, which is a 180 degree polarity shift. So whenever you have a sound source that's within a quarter wave of a wall, what's going to come back off that wall is going to cancel the source. Now, in the case of how does this relate to the real world, when we're talking about speakers that have some kind of directionality, if all of the signal, if we have a speaker here and all the signal is emanating in this direction, we don't have anything bouncing off the wall, so we don't care. But where is this going to start to become an issue? Anybody got a guess? What's that?
Well, yeah, when it hits the other wall in front of it.
I can't hear you.
When it hits the wall in front of it?
Well, yeah, obviously that's a problem, but what I'm really getting at here is if higher frequencies are directional and they travel away from the wall, as we go lower and lower in frequency, the dispersion is get to the point where it's going to wrap around. The low frequencies are going to strike this wall. And when they do, and they come back, if we look at the distance from here to here, and then we calculate it, there will be some frequency that's going to be a quarter wave off that wall, and that frequency will cancel. This is especially an issue when you're dealing with your monitors for your home studio,
yeah,
or in any kind of recording studio situation. If you have your monitors that are off the wall, there will be some frequency that quarter wave is going to relate to. The question is, what is the distance? Is this distance far enough off the wall that the cancellation is occurring at a frequency that has enough directivity that it never strikes the wall in the first place? Or is it going to be a frequency that's low enough that will strike the wall and will cancel?
So it can go both ways.
Yeah, it can go both ways. And you can actually tune this. You may find that moving in closer to the wall is going to prevent the cancellation, but you might also find another effect happening. If you move yourself into a sweet spot here where you're close enough that you've moved the cancellation frequency up out of the band that you care about, you might start getting loading effects on this wall, and the amount of base energy might start to rise as a result of the fact that you're getting space loading off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it can go either way for you, and this is why when you look at professional grade studio monitors, they'll often have some adjustments on the back, like base tilt and things like that, so that if you're in that situation where you're loading onto a wall, you can tilt it down and get rid of that loading effect. But this is a situation that we find in clubs and other situations, churches, all kinds of places, public buildings where they put in subwoofers and they want to get maximum amount of low end, but they don't necessarily know about this phenomenon, so they just kind of put them wherever. Example of this that I love to talk about because it's so real world is a friend of mine used to own a club in downtown Seattle called Sit and Spin. Some of you probably have been there before. Now, in the Sit and Spin, the way the room was shaped was kind of like this. And the stage went like that.
Oh, man.
So there was a subwoofer that was over here, and there was a subwoofer that was over here. It wasn't quite that extreme of an angle, but you get the idea. Now, there was a concrete cinder block wall right here, and I should make this a dot. Oh, actually, it's kind of more like this, and then this is a dotted line. This was a ramp that led up to it. So at this point, you're at the same level of the stage, and this is down on the floor, and then this is concrete cinder block. Now, with the stage being this shape, of course, what would anybody want to do with a small stage? They'd want to get their stage monitors off the stage and onto something else to try to get as much space as possible. So, of course, the house sound guy always used to love to move these things around a little bit so that he could put his monitors on top of them. And in this particular case, what used to happen is a lot of times the singer, guitar player, whatever, on this side would stand in a spot with his mic stand where the guy would move the sub so he could put the monitor on top of it. And I would always keep telling these guys every time I came in, don't put that sub there. But it would inevitably always drift over there. And there'd be times I'd be in this room where I'd be standing over here, and you absolutely wouldn't hear anything at all coming off this sub because it was canceling against this wall. But I could hear the one from across the room.
But there's also a dipole issue there. You could get into even more problems.
Yeah, well, that's another story. But anyway, so this idea of this drifting sub, you know, the bass would go away in that one side of the room, and then I'd go over and I'd move the sub and it would come back again. So just for kicks, let's go ahead and measure what's happening. Because at low frequencies, what's happening here is we're getting radiation off of this box. And that sound is energy, but it's also could be thought of as pressure. So basically, we're building up pressure off of this wall. It's reflecting back, and we get this pressure zone happening over here. And I need an assistant for this.
While you're measuring, a point I can make is also that if you're trying to figure out when something might be directional, if something is less than a half a wavelength of the frequency it's radiating, it's not likely to be directional.
Okay, so it turns
it's
out
physics.
That this subwoofer right here is quarter waving at 33 hertz. So if you're trying to run this box down that low at that frequency, you're going to get zip off of this thing. Well, you'll get something because you don't get a perfect return of energy off the wall, but there would be a cancellation effect for a 33 hertz. Let's see what the other one is doing. It's farther away, and so being farther away, that's going to push the frequency down even lower. And this tape measure only goes down to quarter waves of 28 hertz. So we're at approximately like maybe 26 hertz, 27 hertz right here on this box. If, in fact, you would have pushed your sub over here and got it in just a little closer, like just moving it from there to about there, you probably would have got the sub right into the range where you would have had no bottom end on your kick drum.
And that's why we decided that we could get away with putting it there.
Yeah.
So I remember you got a tape measure out.
Yeah, I mentioned this to you guys at the time that we did the install, and I told you had your choices of where you could go. But if you went on this side, don't get any closer to that wall than here, because I measured it.
Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know, I did the install in this room.
It's just another point to make, I want to make, is that what effect it will have will also vary with your distance in the room, because as you move in the room, the path length is going to change, which gets back to the point I tried to make, is when you have these strong cancellations, it means there's energy somewhere else in the room. If you look what's happening halfway between the wall and the speaker there, you're going to find out something different. If you go against the wall, the place where the cancellation is happening, you're going to blow your ears off at the wall at that frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you see a dip, that's the same as saying there's a peak somewhere else. You know, physics is stubborn. The energy is coming out of the speaker. The question is where it's going.
Right.
And that very often can be really annoying. The thing I was going to say, though, I think I said it, but if you look at if you have a radiator this big, if you measure what a half wavelength, sorry, not a quarter, but a half wavelength is at this distance, it's not going to be directional at any frequency below that. So if you look at these subs, they're what, a foot and a half across? So then, you know, somewhere below, what, 250, 300 hertz, they're not going to be directional at all. And you may occasionally see people that claim otherwise, but physics works.
Yeah, but one of the things that we do there, of course, is we use more of them. And this is one of the issues that there's been a lot of talk about over the years, is how can we actually build up some directivity in our low-frequency devices, since it's physically not practical to try to do it by just making them bigger. So what JJ was just alluding to a little while ago, talking about dipolarization, there's some things that occur there. For instance, in this particular case, these two woofers are so close to each other that they're within a quarter wavelength of one another at the frequencies that we care about. And just by virtue of the fact that they're within a quarter wave of each other, the two boxes together are playing 6 dB louder than they would be if you just had one of them. Now, if you double the energy, you're going to get 3 dB of loudness. So we're accounting for that 3 dB. But the other thing we're getting here is coherent summation within the quarter wave band, and that's giving us another 3 dB for free.
But to point out, that's 3 dB off the front.
Right.
But not off the sides.
Right. So what ends up happening now is, what if we split these subs away from each other and we actually started to move one and forget that that wall exists? A phenomenon is going to happen now where these things are farther apart, maybe they don't couple the same way, but we have sound from both of them radiating forward, but we also have sound from both of them radiating off to the side. The path length differential at some point to the side is going to get to where it's going to create cancellations on the sides, and then it tends to focus everything in a forward direction. So one of the things we can look at doing is we can start building arrays of these things where we can space them and we can use enough of them that they'll not only couple, but they'll actually take their pattern and go from being omnidirectional to being very directional. In fact, one of the things that I ran into in Chicago about a month and a half ago was we had a situation where we wanted to stack all the subs under the stage, but at this particular location, the stage was pretty short. And it turned out that the boxes were just about like half an inch too tall to stand up vertically. So they had to go on their sides. And these particular boxes were not trapezoidal, they were rectangular. So we could stack them. We could go too high if we stacked them on their sides, but we couldn't go vertical. What this ended up doing was forcing us into a situation where we built a wall of subs that, instead of looking like this, looked like this. And the whole array of the subs became so long now that we began to have a bit of a line array effect that was building up. And so the pattern that we would have expected to be extremely broad actually collapsed up so much down the middle that when you went off to either side, you didn't have any bass at all, which was a real problem for us. And so here's what we were up against. We could either go with put some subs over here on this side of the stage and some subs over on this side of the stage and live with finger lobing.
Nasty lobing.
We get nasty lobing problem. Or we put them all in the center, but because of the way we had to build the pattern of the subs, end up with something that just looked like that. And then anybody standing over here wouldn't have anything at all. So we did come up with a solution. And that is exactly what we did. We built them into a pattern like this where we arced them. And by arcing them, we were able to then extend the low frequencies out, at least out to about like that. But we still weren't getting the extreme broad edges that we would have liked to. Probably if we would have had more time, what I would have done at that point would have been to not only arc them, but I had enough boxes that my arc actually kind of looked like this.
Yeah, maybe put a little delay on it.
Yeah, I tried that, but we've had a limitation of processing. So anyways, if I would have had more time, what I probably would have done would take this part of the arc and that part of the arc and separate them by some physical distance and, you know, maybe live with a little bit of lobing, but be able to get us out into the wings just a little bit more than we did.
And to make a point about all this has to be done on the site. I can model the daylights out of this, but the site never works the way the model does. Ever. Have you ever had a model work right?
Actually, this is something that Ryan does all the time. Ryan creates ease models. We have a piece of software called Ease where we can create a model of a room, and then we can put speakers into that room and we can see what they're going to do. But you have to realize that the accuracy here has the following limitations. How good was the data that was acquired in the first place? How accurate is the model that you created? And that right there, those two are going to kill you.
At that point, it's already screwed.
You're dead already.
Right. And then the next one after that is how accurate is the mathematical representation that the computer is going to create for you.
And this, by the way, is one of the things I was talking about, was saying that you find out with, there's two branches of this mathematics. One is very simple, and one is one of those unsolved problems.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of these divergent, you find out modeling a wall like that is actually one of these divergent solutions for which the closer you model it, the worse it works, until you get to some really fine grid. And you still get these really nasty, I would hesitate to call them fractal behaviors, but you get really creepy behaviors because the physics just doesn't work the same way as a mathematic.
Yeah, so the good news is that we get an answer that's close enough that it gives us a pretty good idea of what's actually going
to
happen. It
tells you where to start.
Exactly. Yeah, well, typically what I'll do when I'm designing a room, I've been doing it for so many years that I know pretty quickly what I want to do and have a pretty good idea of what the results are going to be. But the model is a really good reality check. In case there was something that I didn't take into consideration, it might catch it for me, or if there's something about you know, that particular day, you know, I've just come back from a long flight. So the modeling is really good. The modeling is good for another reason too, and that is for people's comfort level. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to spend the kind of dough we're talking about, where somebody might be putting a couple hundred grand into their sound system, then the person who's coming up with the dough wants to have some measure of reassurance that when they put it in, it's actually going to work the way that they want it to. And in December this year, we actually are going to have an AES meeting, although we're still, I need to talk to Jake and make sure that he nailed down the venue for us. But if this all goes as planned, Ryan and I will be doing a meeting where we're going to be talking specifically about designing sound systems for rooms, and Ryan will do some examples of some ease models, and we'll talk about all of what goes into it, because this kind of thing is not only valuable for when you're permanently installing a sound system, but if you're a live sound engineer and you're going to go into a room, it's entirely valid for that as well. There's absolutely no reason why somebody can't figure out in advance exactly what they need to do in a room, even if they've never even been in the room before. As long as you've got a reasonably good idea of the physical dimensions of the room, you can do some very quick and simple things to model the room, even without a computer, and know, you know, this is the kind of gear I want to take in, this is how much gear I want to take in, this is how many watts of power I'm going to need, this is where the speakers are going to go. You can figure out all that stuff in advance. Next question? Yeah? Where are we time-wise?
I turned it off.
Oh, that's good, because I didn't get
it. No, I turned it on and I turned it off.
Okay. Yes?
If anybody's interested in going down the media lab, definitely people down the media lab and show you some of the stuff we got here.
Okay, oh, cool. Yeah. If there's no more questions, then.
Hats and lanyards. Yeah, those things haven't gone anywhere.
Oh, yeah, the hats and lanyards are still there.
Thank you, guys.
Look it up.
Great.
Thank you very much.